Welcome to Cityscapes, a podcast by Committee for Sydney. Jarrett Walker is an international consultant in public transport, planning and policy. He sat down with the committee's CEO, Eamon Waterford, to explain why when it comes to public transport, the bus remains the city's best option.
I have been a planner of public transport networks, principally but not entirely bus networks, for 25 years. And I wrote a little book about that about 6 or 7 years ago now. It's called Human Transit. Very friendly little book that helps people think through the issues of public transport, understand the consequences of whatever views they may be forming, and understand a little bit about what it actually means to lay out a pattern of services that succeed more or less well at helping people go places. Since then, I've had a practice. I have a consulting firm based up in Portland, Oregon, that really works all over the world now, helping cities think about public transport and particularly about bus networks. So we're working right now. We've done major projects in Auckland, New Zealand, the redesign of the Auckland bus network, which is probably the most ambitious you've seen in Australasia, rolled out over the last several years. I've worked on the original design of that network, and it's doing very, very well. And then we're working around the world. I'm working right now on a redesign of the bus network in Dublin, Ireland, for example. I've worked in Russia, of course, across North America. I also lived in Sydney for 5 years in the late aughts, so I'm very familiar with your city and always great to come back and visit.
So you've been involved in a lot of redesigning of transport. What are the principal mistakes that we make when we're thinking about transport?
Oh, there are several. I think the thing that is most risky is that those of us who are in relatively fortunate positions, those of us who are decision makers in the community, who are of course going to tend to be people who are wealthier than average, those of us who are in the bureaucracies, are in danger of treating our own personal experience and our own tastes as a good guide to what would work for the city as a whole. And that's actually a mistake called elite projection. There's nothing wrong with being elite, but it's the problem of forgetting that you are not an average person and that therefore the average person doesn't have your taste, doesn't have your particular preferences, and doesn't necessarily need the level of whatever you feel you need, you know, personal attention, particularly direct services or bus exactly when you need it or whatever else. I think the other thing that is a common mistake, and I see that in Australia a great deal, is thinking about the technologies of transport separately, thinking about there being train service and train planning over here, and bus service and bus planning over there, and ferry planning over there. The goal of a good public transport network is to make everything fit together as a single network, because every single public transport service is more useful to the extent that it connects with other services so that you can go to more places. And I tend to find that when we're focused, first of all, on marketing trains over here and buses over here and ferries over there, we're missing out on that fundamental reality. Now, Sydney's come great strides from when I lived here. At the time, you know, you weren't able to change from one vehicle to another without paying an extra fare. Many of those things have been improved, but I still think we're at a stage where the idea of really planning across all the modes and thinking about how they all work together is still coming along in Australia.
Hmm. So I want to come back to the point around interchange, but you touched on a point. I mean, obviously a lot of our focus in Sydney over the last 7 or so years has been on expanding the rail network. We've got new metro lines. We've got lots of plans for a much expanded network for heavy rail and for metro rail and indeed light rail. Not much focus on buses. But at the same time, huge portions of our city are only accessible by bus, and a bus city is actually the reality, the lived reality for many Sydneysiders. How do we celebrate the bus better?
Well, the point is to celebrate public transport that goes all over the city and that gets to everyone. And I don't, you know, lots of people have emotional attachments to trains and ferries. I don't expect them to form the same emotional attachment to buses. A few people have it. But what we're really celebrating when we is celebrating the total network that includes virtually everyone in the city. And another important thing that we're celebrating when we care about buses is the ability to make it easy to live here without on relatively little income. One of the primary problems we have with rail-based development, we have this problem all over the world, is that so much development, the development that is attracted to rail tends to be relatively expensive. And where lower-income people can afford to live tends, on average, to be away from the rail stations. And what's more, you have in the inner part of Sydney, by which I would mean, you know, everything east of about Strathfield, you have a large, continuously high-density area, much of which is nowhere near a rail station, but where demand is continuous and all-directional all the time. And the train system doesn't do that, and only a bus system that is really designed to work well with the train system, but also designed designed in a particular way so that you're maximizing people's ability to go all over the place, is going to work for you. I don't think you really have that in Sydney.
Yeah.
You have, frankly, a legacy bus system. Many of, as I go around Sydney on this trip, I see pretty much the same bus routes that I remember from 10 years ago. And what's more, those are the bus routes that had been there for decades before that. So that's a typical... So the typical problem there is that your rail system has changed, the shape of your city is changing, and you still have a bus network that's overwhelmingly focused on direct services to the Sydney CBD, and where it's very difficult to get between a lot of other logical places that people would be going. So this is actually very similar to the situation we encountered in Auckland when we began our work in around 2012. There you had a situation in which private operating companies had been designing their own routes, and there were simply two more buses going into the CBD than were needed or than there was room for. And at the same time, it was almost impossible to make orbital trips. So the Auckland network redesign, we were able to create this enormous expansion of bus routes all over Auckland, which come frequently, which come every 15 minutes or better all the time. And that's called a frequent network standard. It's something we've seen over and over in the industry, that when you get to a frequency of about 15 minutes or better all day, the usefulness of the service starts really taking off and patronage starts really taking off if you do it right. And so the designs that I work on, one of the key strategies is usually to deploy a high frequency network, one that is very clear, very easy to read, very easy to understand, and very easy to navigate, so that everyone knows that there's this vast network of bus services where the next one is always coming soon. Turn up and go, always coming soon. Mm. So far, we haven't seen in this state's transport policy the extension of the turn up and go principle to a way of thinking about a category of bus services, the network of higher ridership bus services. But the great thing about turn up and go frequencies is that it means you don't have to run every bus into the CBD, because it's very easy when bus services connect or when they connect with rail services to get off of one and onto another. And that's usually the hardest ask, frankly, of these studies is, oh my God, I have to change buses, you know. But I've been riding a direct bus since 1983, and how dare you change that? But frequently we find we can actually get people where they're going more quickly if we ask them to change buses, if we ask them to change from a bus to a train. And it's ultimately the only way to make buses work in a city of this size. and in a city of this density, is to deploy them very efficiently and to deploy them very importantly for all direction travel and not just for trips into the CBD.
So on that point of interchange, and you rightly point out that people are hesitant to interchange, they don't trust that actually the next service will be there when they arrive at halfway to their ultimate destination. It strikes me that sort of the emergence of real-time data around a whole bunch of different transport modes, not least the bus network, makes that an easier ask. But there's still a psychological barrier for people around interchange. How do we overcome that?
So it makes it an easier ask. And one of the interesting things about the best tools we have now on our phones is that we're starting to see trip planners that actually give you directions based on the actual state of the network rather than the scheduled state of the network.
Right.
So that if there's some sort of disruption, it will not route you that way. It will route you a different way. One of the interesting things about big urban transit networks, though, is that when you design them well, there are usually several different ways you could route through them. And you could take your trip through them. And I think when we get fully to the next generation of real-time data-based trip planners, you'll be able to do that. So if a bus is late, the thing won't tell you to take it. It'll tell you to go a different way. So I think there's a lot of opportunity there. What real-time information does not do is replace the need for frequency.
Right.
And this has been a common misunderstanding about it. People have said, and this is standard elite projection. This is, cool tech kids who can work anywhere, sitting in their cafe. They've got their phone set to Bing when the bus is finally coming, and they don't care when the bus comes because they can work. And I keep having to say, sorry, that's an example of elite projection. Not everyone is in your situation. You work at McDonald's, you have to punch a time clock. You have to get there at 8 o'clock. And if the bus gets there at 7:02 or 8:02, you're going to wait 58 minutes at your destination. Frequency is still fundamental to what makes public transport succeed. We see that everywhere. And as a result, though, because frequency is expensive, a good network design really focuses on deploying frequency in the patterns where they will be the most useful, and not on... as opposed to duplicative patterns where we're running bus routes on top of each other just so that someone won't have to interchange.
So you touched on before this sort of magic point of where you get to 15-minute frequency and everything gets much better. But often the way we sort of appraise the value of various different models is linear. So every minute saved is as good as any other minute saved. But of course that, as you note, is not the way that people think. A 15-minute frequency is much better than going from 30 to 15 is much better than going from 45 to 30.
Right.
How do you measure that in a tangible way when it's hard to predict because we don't do it already?
Well, I would say that what we've seen whenever we run analyses of patronage versus frequency is that we always see this upward curve where when we get better than about 15-minute frequency, we start getting a nonlinear payoff. And we get that all the way through to less than a 10-minute frequency. And at that point, further frequency is really just capacity because people know a bus is coming soon. In Sydney, I think, with this density and with the resources you have, I think you could probably define a frequent network that runs every 10 minutes and that would include many, many lines spanning the city, again, not just into the CBD, but lots of orbital lines, ought to be able to do every 10 minutes. And that's really not much worse than Uber's response time, right? You can look at it on your phone and be reasonably sure it's coming and have those opportunities to go where you need to go. But that people need to go when they need to go, and they need to get there when they need to get there. And if you're not doing that, then you're really running a service of very limited utility. And historically, you can run a service of limited utility and do very well for a long time. So the way it works in Sydney, for example, is you have this enormous share of people taking public transport into the CBD, from which it's easy to infer that public transport is a great success, to which my response is, how else is anyone going to get into the CBD? It's not like there are any other options, really, for most people. And then the other thing is that when you're so focused on that peak commuter, that's a kind of elite projection, too, because the peak commuter is more affluent than average. The average person is more likely to work at Hungry Jack's, is more likely to work at McDonald's, is more likely to work at Bunnings than they are to work in the Sydney CBD and need to be here at 8 in the morning.
And indeed, less than 50% of the population are actually in the workforce. Right. So indeed, the average person is even not working.
And then everyone is going to TAFE, everyone is going to
hospital,
everyone
the doctors.
Is doing all these other things. Now, here's the thing. The problem with that peak focus is that you're not going to get car ownership down. You're not going to get people logically choosing to own fewer cars unless public transport is there for them all the time. And most of the time, you know, most people can afford to take Uber home from the bar at 2 in the morning if they only do that once a week. But most of the time, public transport's got to be there in some form to be relevant to them. And so the historic way that public transport has been tended to be planned in Australia, which is there's this giant CBD, and we just have to have as many trains and buses going into it at 7 a.m. and as many as possible coming out at 5 p.m. First of all, you're running out of space for that. You simply don't have space in your CBDs to do that anymore. And at the same time, you're missing out, you've been missing out on the opportunity to create the real multi-destinational and all-day network that really is what you have for public transport to succeed. Because one of the things that happens as cities grow denser is that the peak gets longer. Finally, you end up, you know, like London, there's just basically 18 hours of peak. It's sort of busy all the time. Because because there's so much going on in such limited space, and everyone has accommodated themselves to the fact that not everyone can get to work at 8 in the morning because it simply doesn't fit in the city. That growth of the all-day demand is actually excellent for public transport because the peak is actually an incredibly inefficient thing for public transport to do. You carry lots of people in one direction, but every one of those trains comes back empty in the other direction, right? You have to pay drivers to report to work for 4 hours, you know, and you'll spend more for that. You have to own all this fleet that you only use very briefly. So while I think you always have to be there for the peak demand, you have to be aware that your growth is actually in the off-peak. And if you are yourself, you know, a someone who commutes into the CBD, you may not realize that. That actually the key to growth now is to not make it better for you, but to make it better for the vast majority of people to whom we can make it better rather inexpensively, right, which is the all-day everywhere travel.
Yeah.
And of course, that goes with your three cities concept. You know, if you want to visualize a future where Parramatta is as much of a center as Sydney City and where places like Strathfield are important destinations, that means you've already committed to an everywhere-to-everywhere kind of network. And that's going to require a real rethinking of the bus system that we haven't seen yet, certainly.
Yeah. So I touched before on sort of, I guess, our core focus on the rail system. That's a very long-term play, right? You decide on a train line you want to build, and it opens 8 years later if you're lucky. Why aren't we better at rapid response with bus networks that strike me as something you can bring into play within 3 months?
You have to have a great deal of political courage. And you have to have a degree of political resolve that will survive changes of government. And because here's how it works. When you propose to change bus services, people who are used to the bus services the way they are scream. And you have to be able to interact with that screaming, understand, sort out real objections that are actually things you can fix. It's very important that these things go through public consultation because that always great ideas turn up and always things turn up that we overlooked. That's important. But ultimately, you have to have the political leadership necessary to say, yes, we know you are used to the bus doing what it does. Now it's going to do something differently. You may have to change buses here, but you will get there just as soon. I'm sorry, we're going to have to do this, even though many of you are angry at that.
Whereas presumably with a major piece of rail infrastructure, you know, it's exciting, you're digging something, and it's very hard to unpick once you start.
One of the things we specialize at in our firm is making bus redesign exciting. And one of the things, I think if you follow the press in the U.S. on this at all, the Houston redesign in particular, when we erased all of Houston's bus lines and put them down differently, that project ran, we did the work in 13 and 14, it was implemented in 15, and it's doing very well by American standards. That really captured some kind of public interest in the U.S. We started seeing a lot of national press about bus network redesign. And that's continued, and that's very exciting, because what we're seeing in the U.S., it's a period, we're in a period of generally downward trending patronage for a variety of reasons, but we are seeing that the networks that have really been reviewed and rethought, and that are not, where we're not just running the same patterns we always ran because we always ran them, are really the ones that are doing best. Mm-hmm. Seattle, Phoenix, Houston, where we work. And that the ones that are just doing the same thing they've always done and not updating their networks, mostly out of fear of that process, mostly out of fear of the fact that lots of people will yell at you when you propose to change anything, are the ones that are stagnating. Mm. So really getting past that fear and getting to a point where enough people understand, yes, I know people are used to the network the way it is, but it is really not working anymore.
Hmm.
Is critical.
Right. I want to touch on new technology and sort of new modes, whether it's shared transport, you mentioned Uber before, whether it's ride sharing, car sharing, on-demand transport that's being trialed at the moment in a couple of locations around Sydney as pilots that are working, seem to be working quite well, but to varying degrees. Trackless trams, you know, enormous expansion of our light rail system, and more buses like B-lines and the longer distance buses as sort of major commuting networks. What's your feeling around these new modes? Are they going to start to replace other alternatives? Is that the future?
With respect, I think innovation or new modes is not a very helpful way to organize these things. You've just listed a whole bunch of things that are very different from each other that are useful in very different situations, right? So, yes, for the mainline high-capacity service, there's room for all sorts of modal inventions, bus rapid transit, the trackless tram, which is kind of bus rapid transit, depending on where you exactly draw the line between your definition of rail and bus. If it doesn't have rails, I'll call it a bus, but okay. The in this completely separate space, and the space that I'm frankly more alarmed by and that I think has more danger of doing harm, is the intense promotion of so-called on-demand services. And if you listen to the companies promoting this, it will sound as though we old fogies run designed fixed routes, rigid fixed routes, because we have rigid minds. And now these smart, new, flexible millennials have come along and liberated us from that by inventing on-demand transport, which is nonsense. We have had on-demand transport for decades. Used to be you called it, Uber, of course, we used to call it a taxi. And on-demand transport has existed, for example, for senior and disabled services. You call up, right? It's been a normal part of the toolbox for extremely low density areas or extremely specialized markets like frail elders. There's nothing new about that. All that we've done is we've moved it over to an app, and that has enabled somewhat faster response times. But here's the thing: how many people can a little van pick up in an hour as it meanders in response to calls? I haven't seen a number better than 7, which is a dreadful, dreadful performance compared to any fixed route. So as long as we're paying the driver, remember, public transport operating cost is mostly labor. As long as we're paying the driver, then the efficient use of the driver's time is the dominant measure of efficiency. And driving around picking people up in ones and twos at their doors is always going to be fantastically inefficient compared to driving down a street and asking people to walk out to you. It is the walking out to the stop, that the gathering of people at stops, that makes public transport and buses, you know, fixed route buses and so on, so fantastically efficient. And even that empty bus that you see driving around in a low density outer suburb that looks empty to you all the time is doing better than the 7 boardings an hour that is the best you can ever hope from any on-demand services. So you really have to cut through the hype. You really have to understand what's actually been invented here, and my view is not very much. We've taken an existing idea of demand responsive transport, we've added apps, we've squeezed a little bit of efficiency out of it. The other thing that you'll find with those services is that their pitch, the marketing, has an element of elite projection to it. Because to lots of people, it just sounds cool. that I can have public transport with all the virtue that's associated with public transport, right? I'm helping save the planet, I'm helping there be fewer cars, and yet it will come to my door. But if it comes to your door and goes to a few other doors, it's not going to pick up very many people compared to what would happen if you actually walked, you know, 300 meters down to your bus stop and caught the bus. And it's to the extent that people are attracted, that, to extent that the marketers of these services are promoting them as a better customer experience, all we're doing is increasing the demand for a kind of public transport that you cannot possibly scale because it is so inefficient. It doesn't scale to the size of the public transport demand in the city. So I think the future is that we will continue to have to take the fixed route bus very seriously as the only thing that can cost effectively liberate large numbers of people all across the city away from the rail lines. We'll have to continue, and these demand responsive services, to the extent, I mean, obviously, private sector, go do what you want, charge full price, see what you can do. They can't. Uber isn't profitable either, as we know. It's just not a profitable business. So instead, they're going after subsidies. And when we're talking about subsidies, we have to say, well, what are we purchasing here? And if all we're doing is drawing people off of public transport to the extent that, you know, Uber has clearly been doing in the U.S., you know, we're having a net negative impact. We're increasing traffic congestion. We're increasing volumes of cars on the street above what public transport was, and we're seeing that dramatically in a lot of American cities. Very definitely tied to the emergence of Uber and Lyft. And then we're also seeing, and then we have them looking for subsidies for a fundamentally inefficient product compared to fixed routes. And the trick is, you know, a lot of people are going to think, yeah, that would be cool, that would be good, I support that, I would like something to come to my door. But you cannot possibly afford to have something come to everybody in Sydney's door at the time they need it, and you don't have room on the streets for it either.
So I mean, it sounds like your sort of take on, I guess, that, you know, whether it's called last mile or on demand or these sorts of models, you see them as a threat to public transport rather than to private vehicle usage.
They can be part of a suite of options. Right. So how does one decide to not own a vehicle, or how does a couple decide to share a vehicle instead of having one each? Well, it has to do with the full suite of options that you have and where you're going, what you're likely to be doing, and what you're likely to need. It's always good for there to be more options, including expensive options that you use rarely. Like for most people who can't afford to use Uber all the time, you know, you take Uber home from the bar or whatever. You take Uber when you've gone to a big box store and have, you know, seven bags or something. But you can't, you don't use it all the time. That's all. It's fine that it exists. But again, private sector, do what you want. The demand for, when you start demanding public subsidies, you start demanding that we spend money to pay a driver to carry seven people when we could be paying him to carry 50 people. And now you have to ask, why are those seven people so important, right? Why are those seven people?
Which presume, I mean, given we already subsidize private vehicle usage fairly heavily in this country,
right?
That then naturally leads to a conversation about road pricing and the need to sort of better efficiently, you know, encourage people out of their private motor vehicle.
And road pricing is one of those things that is just inevitable. You get to where London and Singapore are, and there's simply no other way to do it.
Right.
I think it's a very exciting time for your city. I think that the investments that you're making in large-scale transport in the rail and metro systems are very exciting. Light rail. I do think that the Australian, as I travel around the world, what I'm struck by about the Australian conversation is how obsessed it is with infrastructure, and that the news about public transport is mostly news about infrastructure. And it's understandable when you're talking about roads, because with roads, infrastructure is really what it is. You build the thing and then people use it. But public transport is service. When you build the infrastructure just sits there, and then you have to run service on it. And that's why there's such a thing as service planning, and it's why infrastructure has to make sense for operations first and foremost.